Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. Really pleased to have back Patty Nagai, retired UW Extension horticulture educator. And today we'll talk with her about what you find in a midsummer garden. There's sometimes some challenges and a lot of times opportunities. So we'll take your questions and comments as we move along today. And you're certainly welcome to join in right now if you want to. The number to call is 1-800-642-1234. Or you could email us, email address ideas@wpr.org. Patty Nagai, welcome. It's good to see your smiling face in person.
Thank you, Larry. I am so happy to be here. I've done the show by phone a couple of times, and I miss seeing you and being here in Madison, so it's great to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Great to have you back with us. What's the year been like so far for gardeners, in your estimation?
I think for the most part, it's been very successful. I've seen a lot of gardeners coming into the nursery where I work and purchasing lots and lots of annual flowers, but also perennials. And many people are investing in native plants and butterfly gardens. They are doing a lot to help support our birds and bees and butterflies, which I love. I love to help that effort and help them make good selections. I think people have been gardening more since the start of the pandemic. So we're seeing a lot more people investing their time in growing herbs and vegetables, whether it's in a window box or a container on their patio or a raised bed or in a more traditional kind of garden way. People are, I think, outside more. And our weather's been so weird, honestly, but it's Wisconsin. I think the two things go hand in hand. But we've had this up and down weather all spring and summer. You know, it was super cold, and then it was super hot, and then it was super cold again. And I think it created a lot of challenges for our gardeners early on. And now we're seeing more heat than we normally do, so things are, in some cases, ahead of where they normally would be. And there are a lot of challenges that people have this time of year that they might not have noticed early on, but now they're seeing insect problems, or maybe a shrub or a tree has some issues that's not growing quite like it has in the past.
Yeah, like they thought it should. Well, Bonnie in Wanakee emailed a photo, and you had a chance to look at it to identify for her. She thinks it's a weed, but she's just started using natives in her garden, and she wanted to make sure it was a native and not a weed. And it's appearing in the dirt edges in the garden bed where she has coneflowers, daylilies, sedum, black-eyed Susan, astilbe, and hibiscus.
Right.
And it's
not any of those. No, it is definitely not. But it's interesting where the plants are appearing. So typically when we see things appearing on the edge of the garden like that, it's that they might have been deposited by a bird or a squirrel in some cases. They might have washed out of the soil and accumulated right there on the edge. But, you know, I looked at the photo and, you know, my best guess is that it might be some sort of lobelia, which can be a native plant. So it could be the great blue lobelia or the red cardinal flower. It has that same form and the leaf shape and the slight serration on the edges of the leaves and that little bit of a redness to it, just a tiny little bit.
Yeah.
But like you said, it really will help if she's interested in finding out what it really is. Go ahead and let it flower. And then she'll know for sure. If it's one of the lobelias, it'll very soon send up a flower stalk. Mm. And if it has red flowers, it's a cardinal flower. If it has blue flowers, it's probably a great blue lobelia or something like that. But, you know, when plants appear in your garden like that and they're all clustered together, a lot of times they are weeds and the seeds have been deposited by an animal or the wind or something else. But sometimes they're seeds that you might have turned up. I mean, she might have had lobelia in that garden years ago and it self-seeded.
Yeah.
So lobelia is very good about self-seeding.
All right. You can join in, too, by the way. You can also email us, ideas@WPR.org, or you can phone 1-800-642-1234. Let's take a call from Susan in Waupaca. Susan, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. I have a question about lilacs. I have several plantings of lilacs in my yard, and one specific area, the leaves are all turning brown and does not look good at all. I don't know if it's a fungus. I don't see any bugs on it, but should I just leave them? Now, I've also noticed many of my my tiger lilies also are turning brown. I doubt if it's the same thing, but should I leave the lilacs and hope they come back next year, or would you cut them back? Or are you familiar with this problem this year?
Well, there are a lot of things that can go wrong with lilacs that can cause browning leaves. And so have you had a more of a droughty condition in Waupaca, or have you had enough rainfall? Drought?
There's never enough rainfall. I haven't had to water my vegetable garden very often.
Okay.
So,
well, then
I
they
never
should.
Water the lilacs.
And these are established lilacs. They're pretty good sized.
Yes.
Okay. So there are a couple of things that you can consider. One is that lilacs are susceptible to verticillium wilt. That's the worst case scenario. So if we think there's a possibility of that, it's always recommended that you take a sample of the wood as close to the base of the plant as possible and send it into the plant disease diagnostic clinic. And there's a great explanation of how to do that on the website, on Dr. Huddleston's website. So you can go there and get the specifics and where to send it. And you do need a sample that's as close to the base of the plant as possible. And the more sample, the better for that particular diagnosis. If you're seeing dieback, if you're just seeing brown leaves, it's probably not verticillium. But if you're seeing dieback of branches, there's a chance that that's what it is. We're a little bit late in the season to prune lilacs. I mean, you can prune them. You can prune them anytime, but you won't have any flowers next year. So generally, pruning of lilacs is best done earlier in the spring, right after the flowers have bloomed, would be the best time to prune if you're trying to preserve flowers for next year. The second best time to prune, which is actually the best time for the health of the plant, is actually in early spring before the buds break. But if you do that, you're definitely going to be cutting all of your flower buds off. You could selectively prune back some of the stems all the way back to the ground and pull those branches out. And again, the branches that you leave will have blooms next year. The other thing that can cause it, besides drought or verticillium wilt, are powdery mildew. Mm. Powdery mildew is really prevalent on lilac, especially the common lilac, but it'll get on the other lilacs as well. And that can cause browning leaves. So if you look up on the plant and if the tips of the branches are still green and growing, if you see any little white spots or white powdery stuff, then chances are it's just powdery mildew. And that's just a seasonal affliction that is very opportunistic. It's just if the conditions are right for powdery mildew, you're going to get it. You're correct in that the daylily problem is probably not the same as the lilac. However, if you're under a drought condition, daylilies certainly will brown out if they don't get enough water.
And tiger lilies.
Or tiger lilies. I'm sorry. I was thinking daylilies. The same thing can happen with those tiger lilies. They can brown out from lack of water as well. Alternatively, they can brown out from too much water. So you have to kind of go out there and judge the condition of your soil and go from there.
Susan, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. And the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic, if you just write that in a search engine, you're going to find it. Or
right, PDDC, I think.
PDDC.
Wisconsin, PDDC, yeah. It'll get you there too.
Yeah, there you go. Thank you. Jim and Stevens Point, on to you now. Hi, Jim.
Good morning. I'm actually on my way to pick up a couple of well-priced hydrangea, and I'm wondering if I should be planting them now, or should I wait for a month and plant in September when the hot August is done?
Well, I will tell you that you can keep them in the pots because, of course, we do that at the nursery. They're sitting out, and we have to water them every single day to keep them healthy. They would prefer to be in the soil as soon as possible. But when you plant them, you need to water them really thoroughly, even before you plant them. Water them really thoroughly. And if you can knock off some of that nursery soil and get those roots untangled and get them, just don't knock it all off, but get them in a little bit better condition to make their way in the real world, that would be great. Dig your hole. Don't dig it too deep. Make sure that it's not going to settle and that plant's going to end up in a bowl. So make sure that your hole is actually maybe a half inch to an inch shallower than you think it needs to be, as opposed to deeper. And then completely fill that hole with water so you know that that ground and the surrounding area is completely saturated. Plant it. Fill it back in with your native soil. And then actually water it again. Once you do that thorough watering while you're planting, you can just water it once a week really deeply to make sure that you're getting that entire root zone wet. And always apply a really heavy layer of mulch after you plant. That will help preserve the moisture in the soil, but it also helps moderate the temperatures so that the soil around the base of the plant and then that root zone doesn't get excessively hot. And, you know, normally in Wisconsin, we don't worry about such things, but we've had some really hot days.
Yeah, yes.
So it's just a good idea to apply a really nice thick layer of mulch around the root zone.
There you go, Jim. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. Let's go to Jane in Menominee. Hi, Jane.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My concern is hollyhocks. I have been working for 5-6 years trying to establish a nice bed of hollyhocks in the front yard garden.
Mm-hmm.
And I understand that they're biennials. I mean, they come up every other year.
No, they don't.
And,
okay, go ahead. I'm sorry. Finish your question.
But my question really is, I have some of this rust spores on them, and I have like iridescent bugs that love to mate in my flower buds. All over them.
Yes.
And one young man thought it was potato bug. He gave me some spray. Okay, and it didn't work. and the rust leaves I pick off, but literally I have stalks with dying flowers at the top.
Yes.
So do I have to start all over?
What do you think, Pat? I think we know what the bugs are.
Well, yeah, you have a lot going on there. Let's dissect your issues, your garden challenges. So the insects are Japanese beetles. And the Japanese beetle is very popular this year. Mm. It is in full force. There are some plants I will treat for Japanese beetle using a systemic insecticide, which means that I apply it to the ground earlier in the year and to protect. I use it on my roses. But that particular insecticide doesn't transfer over to the flowers, so the Japanese beetles actually still get into the flowers, but they don't eat the foliage. One of the things that is I find very, very consoling is to go out with a bucket of soapy water.
Knock them off.
And you just hold the bucket. It could be a plastic container. It could be anything. Just hold it underneath the flowers or the leaves where the Japanese beetles are. And you don't have to touch them. You just have to come close to them. Or you can use, anything to tap the leaf or tap the flower. And those Japanese beetles drop straight down. That's their defense mechanism. They drop straight down into that soapy water, and then you've done your job for the day. There are a number of sprays you can use. There are some organic sprays as well as some synthetic sprays. I'm not sure what the young man gave you. There are a lot of people who use neem oil, which is an organic alternative for insect control. And neem is an interesting product. It sometimes kills the insects because it is an oil, so it acts as a suffocant. But with Japanese beetles, from what I've read and some of the research that's been done, it's almost like it acts as a deterrent. But the issue with any of the organic compounds is that you have to do repeated applications. So there's that. Any of the products that contain, like, the pyrethrins, which is also a natural organic product, those can work on Japanese beetles as well. But truly, I find the best method is knocking them off into a bucket of soapy water. It works. It works really well.
It doesn't really take that long either.
It doesn't. And it's kind of satisfying to see them in that soapy water swimming around for a short while. It sounds cruel. I know. I'm so sorry. As far as the rust goes, rust is a fungal disease that is really, really prevalent on hollyhocks. There are, again, some organic products containing copper and sulfur that you can apply early on. But once you've lost the foliage, it's really too late. You have to actually apply, whether it's an organic or a synthetic fungicide, you have to apply it before the disease takes hold. So the very first signs of any of those rust spots, you have to get out there and spray the plant. Because those fungicides, whether they're organic or synthetic, they really act as protectants, so they protect the foliage from future infections, but they're not really going to cure the disease once it's in the leaves. So you need to get ahead of the disease and make sure that you're applying those products ahead of time.
Yeah, there you go, Jane. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Patty Nagai, our guest today, back with us once again, retired UW Extension horticulture educator. Tyler Ditter's our engineer, by the way. Jill Nadeau, our producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. So, how is your garden growing these days? Hi, Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network as we take a look at summer challenges and opportunities in the garden with our guest, Patty Nagai. Great to have her back. And certainly, if you want to join in, the number to call is 800-642-1234. Or you could email us, email address ideas@wpr.org. And let's take another call. Don in Bayfield County will give you a chance. Hi, Don. Thanks for calling.
Yes. Say, I grow asparagus, mm-hmm. and I have one female plant, and I take the seeds and I strew them around the yard. So what can I expect in 3, 4, or 5 years with the seeds?
Well, you know, asparagus is interesting. It actually germinates very readily, and asparagus growers, like professional asparagus farmers, will tell you that the asparagus itself can be the biggest weed problem that they have because the seeds do germinate so readily. The seeds require light to germinate, so as long as they're just lying on top of the ground and they get enough moisture, eventually they will grow. Take about...
It's a long time.
Well, you know,
thing.
It's a long time. So you'll see growth. You'll see growth within a year. You'll see growth. But as far as growth that you could harvest for asparagus... Normally, when we buy crowns, those crowns are 2, 3, or 4 years old. So you're looking at least 4 years, 3 to 4 years probably, before you would be able to harvest anything from those seedlings, which is one of the reasons that asparagus growers consider those seedlings weeds. And they would prefer to have all male plants so that they don't even get the seedlings in their fields. And if you notice, when you go to buy asparagus crowns, most of the crowns that are sold in garden centers and even online, they're mostly male plants.
Yeah.
And that's the reason for that. But you will get plants. They will germinate. I guarantee you they'll grow.
But you're going to wait 3, 4 years.
Yeah.
There you go.
Maybe he's got space and time, and yeah. It's not a big deal.
If it was me, I'd go with the crowns. There you go, Don. Thanks a lot for calling. Tom in Darien, your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi. I have a question about leaves curling on an apple tree.
Mm-hmm.
I just planted it in the spring.
Uh-huh.
I planted it the way you said. I filled the water, dug it down. Filled it full of water,
rain
deep down, and then put the tree in there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it was doing really good. It actually got a couple apples on it. They fell off.
Right.
And now the leaves are starting to curl.
Okay. Well, there are a couple of things that can cause leaf curl on apples. Of course, one of them is drought or not enough water during this latter part of their growing season. That's a possibility. There's also, you said it was newly planted this year, right? So
right.
There could still be some acclimation going on. It takes a while for trees to fully adapt to their new location. And I'm hoping that when you planted, you did not plant the tree any deeper than the actual base of the trunk. So you have to identify where those major roots are coming out in the apple tree, and then those need to be your soil level. So it's really important not to plant trees too deeply. Deep. So, and if that's the case, then I would recommend that when fall gets here, that you actually resituate that plant and lift it up a little bit if that's the case. If you feel like you planted it correctly and the roots are high enough in the soil, then it's a matter of making sure that you're watering weekly so that the plant is not drying out. Mulch, again, mulch is super important to keep that soil temperature moderated and also keep the moisture onto that root zone and to give it a little bit of extra protection over the winter to protect those roots from the cold temperatures and the vacillating temperatures, the up and down. There is an insect that can cause leaf roll in apple trees and other fruit trees, and it's called the leaf roller insect.
Yeah.
So if it's that, you should be able to take one of those leaves and physically open it up, and you would actually see the little, probably a cocoon at this point, a little mass of white stringy stuff in there, and that's an insect. If that's the case, then you could remove those leaves and destroy them, because it'll be a perpetual issue for you in the coming years. For apples, it's important to follow a recommended insecticide, fungicide program. Even if you're doing organic apples, there are organic products that you can use. Apples are so susceptible to so many different diseases and insects. It's really important to look over that and try to protect them as much as possible. It's great that you got a couple of apples, but you want to make sure that you protect the tree for the future, because you should have apples, you know, for the next 20, 25 years. So if you go online to the publications, the UW publications, they have some fabulous publications on apples, not only how to train the apple tree and how to prune it correctly, but also how to do the different chemical applications and when those applications should take place.
Yeah. Good advice for sure. Tom, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Susan emailed about planting on hydrangeas. She lives in a sandy pine forest area of northern Wisconsin, and she wonders, would your recommendation to not create a bowl when planting a hydrangea apply to her as well?
It does. It applies no matter where you are. You know, the difficulty in growing in the sandier soils is that you will have to water more frequently. In some of those areas where we have sandy soils, especially if you're talking about an area that's a little further north, a little more shaded, rainfall may not be an issue. You may still have plenty of rainfall to support that hydrangea growth. But you don't want to create a soil environment where the hydrangea stays in one, the roots stay in that same area where the nursery pot originally was. You want those roots to spread out into the soil. So if you do a lot of soil amendments in that one small area where the plant is,
it's going to want to stay right there.
It's going to want to stay right there. You need those roots to grow and expand. So when you do your watering, especially in sandy soils, but it's true for all soils, you don't just water right at the base of the hydrangea. When you first plant, it's important to make sure that you water right at the base of hydrangea, because that's where all the roots are. But you want to water all the way around where you want those roots to grow, because you want a massive root system. That's what's going to have that hydrangea do its best.
Let's take another call. Beth in Grafton, it's your turn. Hi, Beth. Thank you for calling.
Hi. My question is, my daughter just bought a house in Cole Air, Wisconsin, and turns out the front yard is full of Canadian thistle.
Oh, I'm sorry.
Canada thistle. Are you sure it's Canada thistle?
It's not like bull thistle or musk thistle.
Well,
there's so many.
Said it was Canadian thistle. I have no clue. But so my husband and her pulled it all out, and I know that that's not the end of it. So what is the best? Is this going back already, of course? What is the best thing for them to do? They have a lot of it, a lot of gardens full of it.
So it's in their actual gardens, or is it in their lawn?
Both.
Okay. So thistle is an even if it's the native thistles, you know, for the most part, you don't want them in your yard or your garden. It's been a good year for thistle. I will tell you that even with all of my precautions and weeding, I have thistle everywhere this year. It's just a good year for it. And so the birds help plant it for you. And once it gets established and you get those little root pieces in the ground, it just keeps popping up. I've gone to extreme measures this year. I've done a lot of hand pulling, but I've also used glyphosate to try and kill it in my flower beds and in my vegetable garden. I don't usually do this, but it's been an exceptional year. I've pulled and pulled and pulled, and I finally broke out the chemicals because I just could not keep up with it. I was out there every day pulling thistle, every single day.
Boy.
I mean, it's just a good year. And everybody I've talked to has been kind of the same way. It's just a banner year for thistle. So the good news about thistle, of course, are the seeds are great for the birds. But then, you know, they will spread them around.
Yes.
And you'll just have more. In the lawn, of course, you don't want to use glyphosate in your yard. It'll kill your grass. And, of course, you can't just willy-nilly spray glyphosate all over the place because it is a total vegetation killer. It'll kill everything. So you have to do the application very carefully. Some people use a painting method. Some people will just adjust their spray nozzle so that it's in a almost like a little stream, drippy stream, not a spray, but just a drippy stream so that you can really control where it goes. And then you just need to get it on a leaf towards the center of the plant, preferably doing it in the evening when the plant is naturally translocating things down to the root system. And you should be able to take care of it.
Beth, good luck. Thank you so much for calling.
Yeah, it makes me sad.
Yeah.
It just makes me sad.
So hard to kill. Canada thistle in particular.
It is. And, you know, the native thistles, there's a place for those. And we love those native thistles in their space. But they still, you know, they don't really fit in our vegetable garden.
Beth, good luck again. Thank you. Dawn in La Crosse, on to you now. Hi, Dawn.
Hi, good morning. I have two questions. I just planted this year for the first time some milkweed that I had sent for before I heard about how bad the monarchs are doing. So I'm glad I got it. But I'm wondering if this first year, if it's going to attract them or if it needs to be more established. And then my second question is, do you know if there are any programs or anything that are to encourage communities and cities to plant more milkweed to help our monarchs out? Oh,
that's a really good question. I've been seeing more and more things popping up on Facebook. And, of course, there's been a lot of discussion about it with gardeners coming into to the garden centers. There are a lot of groups. I think that the Monarch Society out of Milwaukee is still very active, and the Xerces Society is still active. That's Xerces. So you can go online and find those organizations that do keep track of a number of community efforts for monarch preservation. So the planting of the milkweed is super important. Diversity in the landscape, of course, is also important because the monarch, of course, needs the common milkweed for its eggs and larvae production. But providing sources of food for the adults is also super important. So Joe Pieweed, Asclepias tuberosa, the butterfly weed, all of those kind of things, coneflowers. There are lots of ways that you can build yourself a beautiful garden and provide a nice, diverse selection of food for the monarchs. You can also look at different types of milkweed. There are the swamp milkweeds and the whorled milkweeds that also provide food source. You might see some different types of butterflies on some of those plants, but it's good to make every little effort that you can in your own gardens. And I do encourage you to go online and look for those broader community efforts, because I think that there are a number of communities that are doing more.
Dawn, thank you very much, and good luck with your efforts in relation to the now endangered species, the monarch.
I know.
Yeah. It's, well, the good part about calling them endangered is that then their money kicks in, and efforts kick in to help.
Yeah.
So that's I guess about the only good thing about it.
Mm-hmm.
Jack in Cedarburg, on to you now. Hi, Jack.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I have a non-fruit-bearing pear tree. It's about 11 years old, and they send up these shoots around the base of the tree, and I can find them as far as 15, 20 feet away. Also, I asked my local garden center about this, and they said, well, cut them below the soil line and then spray the exposed cut with this product called Sucker Punch.
Yeah.
It's a purple top thing, but it doesn't seem to do anything. And every year it seems like it's getting more and more prolific. Is there any other suggestions you might have?
Well, the one suggestion I have, you won't like. And it's to take the tree down. Which I know that's a kind of a tongue-in-cheek answer, but it's kind of the truth. Those pears are notorious for suckering, and there are a couple of different products that you can use. You can use the Sucker Punch or Sucker Stop. They are hormonal-based products, plant growth regulators that are supposed to slow the process down. Mixed success, I hear, from different people about using those products. It is a constant battle trying to get those suckers out. Some people will tell you that if you actually can pull the suckers rather than cut them, you will have better success at controlling them. I know people who have cut them and then actually applied glyphosate to the sucker, which is risky because, of course, it can be taken up by the tree and you could end up killing your tree. I know people who just go out there on a weekly basis and just take care of suckers, just keep doing it over and over and over again. There are several species of trees that are like that. The poplars will like that. The poplars, those ornamental pears. Crab apples in some cases will do that too. And it's just a constant that you take with those particular species of trees. That's really about all you can do. Sorry.
Yeah, sorry,
I'm so
Jack.
Sorry. I'm just saying sorry a lot. I'm so sorry.
There you go, Jack. Thank you for calling. On to Barbara in Grand Marsh next. Hi, Barbara.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
Well, I planted it before I knew bamboo.
Oh, dear.
And I call it the threaded bamboo. And I know that they say you're supposed to go down to the root part. I can't even get in there. And since I don't have any, is it koalas or pandas that eat that?
Right.
I don't have that in my yard in Grand Marsh, so what do I do? Should I just keep cutting it off?
This is another, I'm really sorry. I am, you know, bamboo, it looks so attractive in the catalogs, and you think, oh, this is so cool, and it'll provide a screen, and I love the way bamboo sounds when it rattles in the wind. You know, I used to live in Japan, and they have big bamboo forest, and it's just so amazing and beautiful. But it is a horribly invasive plant, and it is not meant to be in Wisconsin. It is just, it's just not a good plant. It will take over, and it is very difficult to control. Digging down and trying to get the roots out is step one. Step two is going to have to be chemicals, and I believe in this case, and I would check I would check on the labels first, but I'm thinking that triclopyr is a better option than glyphosate for bamboo. It seems like that is a little bit bigger punch.
Yeah.
So triclopyr is a nice deadly plant chemical that can help you get it under control. But it's going to be a process. It's not a simple dig it up, apply a chemical once, because you're going to be seeing them sprout up again and again. It'll probably take you a few years, actually, to get it under control.
To get it all, yeah.
If it's been allowed to spread for any amount of time, it'll take a while to get it under control.
Is there one species or one type that does not do that, stays where it is?
There are some clumping bamboos that say that they're supposed to stay where they are.
But
I don't even trust those. There was someone down in Racine who planted some of those clumping bamboos down at the Racine Zoo, and they were popping up on the other side of the road. So,
oh man,
yeah, it's not
not good.
It's just a species that should not be planted here. It should, and you know, for a long time, and I don't even know if it's on the DNR's do not plant list, because for a long time people thought it won't grow here. You know, it's like kudzu. We don't have to put that on the invasive species list because it won't survive our winters. But it does survive. In certain areas, it will survive. So
there's the bad news.
If you have to
Barbara.
Have it, put it in a pot, but don't put it out in the garden.
Yeah. Barbara, thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Patty Nagai, our guest today, retired UW Extension horticulture educator. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here, taking a look at what's going on in the flowers and the vegetables and the trees and the shrubs with our guest, Patty Nagai, retired UW Extension horticulture educator. Great to have her back. Really enjoy working with her. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234. Email to ideas@wpr.org. And Patty Delia emailed for an ID of a bug you've had a chance to look at. It's eating her tiger lilies.
Mm-hmm.
Could it also be eating her grape leaves and most of the grapes? That could be...
Probably Japanese
that's
beetle.
That's Japanese beetle.
But
probably.
Unfortunately, the photo that she sent in makes me think that she does have this new invasive species of lily leaf beetle that is apparently spreading around the state. So I've actually never seen this beetle, but it is in the central part of the state. That's where it was first identified, and it has been spreading. So it's been in the state of Wisconsin since 2014. So I'm sure it has made its way around.
Yeah.
And it's called the lily leaf beetle. If you go online and just type in Wisconsin lily leaf beetle, you'll come up with this article that was written by Heather Schlesler with the UW Extension that has some pictures and some different information about it, what the eggs look like and everything. Let's see, current management, mechanical. Take it off. Look for the eggs. Make sure you pull that off. Anything. And just like the Japanese beetle, guess what you're supposed to do with them?
Knock them into soapy water.
Drop them into a bucket of soapy water. It's like the insect's last bath. Yes. Yeah, so there are some, apparently, they're working on some parasitoid biological controls. I'm not sure if those are actually available yet. But neem oil, insecticidal soap are some good organic options. And then pyrethrin, and then you can also use the permethrins or the deltamethrins, any of those methrins, which are the synthetic versions of the pyrethrins. Those will work on it as well. But if you can mechanically remove it and look for the eggs and get the eggs off too, you'll be one step ahead of them.
Yeah. Kurt and Poinette, we'll give you a chance to join in. Hi, Kurt.
Hello, thanks for taking my call,
sure.
Larry. Patty, I have a 10-year-old crabapple in the backyard.
Mm-hmm.
Very heavy fruit load this year. The branches are way down and the tips are almost touching the ground.
Wow.
The tree is only 15 feet tall. The crab apples are a half inch to three quarter inch diameter. What's up?
Well, did you have crab apples on your tree last year?
Small, very small, yes.
So the reason I asked is, well, you're in a different part of the state than I am in, but last year I had one little cluster of crab apples on my very mature crab apple tree that has always produced super well because the blossoms got killed. We had a late frost that killed all of my blossoms. So, in fact, they killed in the bud stage, so I never had flowers on my tree at all. Oh. They never opened. I never had any flowers. And so then I didn't really have any fruit. I had this one little cluster that was kind of closer to the house, probably protected a little bit. And this year, my tree is loaded with crab apples. There's so many on the tree that, like you, the branches are hanging down. They've been dropping crab apples already, which is what a fruit tree will do when it has too much fruit. It'll naturally thin some of them. If you're concerned about the weight of the branches, it would behoove you to go out and actually clip some of those clusters off and just go ahead and do the thinning yourself. But the tree is probably okay. At 10 years old, it's probably stronger than you think it is, and it'll be okay. But I just think that it's an interesting response to a bad year in the previous season.
Very interesting.
Mm-hmm. That's my guess.
Yeah, I think it's a good
guess. My educated guess, but...
A very good educated guess. Kurt, thanks for calling. John in Waterloo, on to you now. Hi, John.
Hi, good morning. I have a question about what I think might be giant hogweed. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure, though. The pictures that I've looked at shows more of a flat type head on it, where these are round. These are a globe head. They're still quite tall. They're
How
probably
tall?
7 feet tall. Oh. Oh, at least 7 feet, and they've got a hollow stem on it. But I don't know what the species is, and I don't know how careful I need to be around. I wore gloves when I cut them down, and I burnt the tops to get rid of them. But I don't. This is the first year I've seen them along the creek that runs through our property, and they were just loaded down there this year.
Mm-hmm. What do the leaves look like?
Well, they look a lot like the pictures that I've seen of the giant hogweed. They've got a flat leaf with points on the ends. But the big difference that I've noticed is that the top itself, the seed head, is absolutely spherically round on what we have. And the pictures I've seen of the hogweed are more flat.
Yeah. I think what you have probably is cow parsnip instead of giant hogweed. So the leaves are a little bit different on the two. The cow parsnip, the leaves are a little bit pointy, like a maple leaf, kind of, but bigger, of course. And then on the giant hogweed, the leaves are a little bit more rounded. The giant hogweed is really tall. Depending on where it's growing, it can get, I think it can get like 9-10 feet tall. Cow parsnip is way more common, and I have it in my backwoods. I still try to get rid of it, though, because it's good that you're taking precautions, because even with the cow parsnip, you can have a reaction to the sap, just like with the yellow flowering version. You can get you can have a reaction to it on your skin, so it's good to take precautions when you're working with things like that. But the cow parsnip is way more common, and it's probably what you have. But if you take pictures of the foliage and take pictures of the flowers and then get some measurements on it, if you want to be absolutely certain, you can take those into your local extension office. And even if you don't have a horticulturist there, your ag agent should be able to tell the difference between them and make sure that what you have is cow parsnip and not giant hogweed. I think they're still monitoring giant hogweed. So if it is giant hogweed, the DNR will probably want to know, you know, where it is.
John, good luck. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Jan in Viroqua, Your turn. Hi, Jan.
Hi. I've been weeding a lot and leaving some of the soil denuded, and I'm wondering, are there situations or types of plants, for example, Creeping Charlie, where it's advantageous to the plants that you're trying to grow to leave them there?
Mm. Is it ever advantageous to leave Creeping Charlie in your garden? Only if you really like it, because it will take over. So it's a ground cover, and it does a great job of being a ground cover. But it's so aggressive, it actually will climb up your other plants. It will get into your lawn. It has no respect for boundaries. It grows like crazy everywhere. It will actually grow up ornamental grasses and smother them. Creeping Charlie is a phenomenal plant. It has beautiful little purple flowers.
Mm-hmm. First to bloom in spring for the insects?
Yes, it's a great, yes, absolutely. But if you don't keep it under control, it will completely take over. So in that particular example, I would say no, not unless you really love it. I know people who have let Creeping Charlie grow on the side of their house where they don't have anything else growing, and it makes a really nice little ground cover. And then they try to just keep it contained in that area between like their neighbor's driveway and the side of their house. But it's hard to contain it. It is just a very vigorous little plant. So my feeling is you should try to get it out of there. There are times when I leave plants because I don't like to have bare soil. But most of the time, if I have bare soil and I'm not ready to plant it yet with other desirable plants, I just bring some mulch in and cover it. That way you keep other seeds from germinating and you don't end up with something else that you don't want.
There you go, Jan. Thank you. Nancy in Star Prairie. On to you. Hi, Nancy.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
My question is, I have an abundance of hostas, and when is a safe time to transplant them?
You know, the fall is a great time to do it. I wouldn't do it now unless, for some reason, you just absolutely have to do it. It's better to wait until they're starting to senesce a little bit and the soil is still nice and warm. We're getting good rainfall. You know, all the conditions are right. You know, gardening in the fall is something that's greatly overlooked in this country.
Yeah.
In other parts of the world, Europe, New Zealand, Japan, people know that gardening in the fall it's the best time to plant. It's the best time to clean things up and move things around and divide and conquer. It's a fabulous time because the soil is moist, the soil is warm, and when you're planting and moving things around, whether it's shrubs, trees, perennials, that fall weather and that condition of the soil in the fall is perfect for root development. And that's what you want. That's what you want for a really good, healthy plant. You have to remember that the roots are the foundation for everything. And if you have good, healthy roots established, the upper part will reward you next spring. So I would say dig and divide in the fall and go ahead and get them in the ground. Make sure that you water them when you plant them again, and then apply a nice, healthy layer of some sort of organic mulch, whether it's bark or shredded wood or whatever you use. Just don't put rocks on them.
Yeah, just don't put rocks.
No rocks, please.
Nancy, thank you so much for calling.
Yeah.
Thinking about vegetables for mm-hmm. a minute and, mm-hmm. and sort of fall planting.
Right.
There's some things we can do that
Absolutely.
Really are better.
Absolutely. So it's really funny that people think this time of year, oh, it's too late to plant anything in my vegetable garden. You know, I've missed my opportunity. But in actuality, you can still grow a lot of things planted now. For example, summer squashes. You know, you lost your summer squash to the squash bug. You know, maybe you know your plant was just starting to produce and then it wilted and died because that little critter got in the stem. Maybe you stopped harvesting your squash and let it go because you had too much. But now, actually, is the time to plant because the squash bug is gone.
Yeah.
It only has that one little season in the spring. So you will the plants only take about 40 to 45 days to produce. So then you could have, in another 40 days, mm-hmm. you'll be ready for zucchini and summer squash again. You'll be ready for them.
Yeah.
So you could plant now. The other thing is things like bush beans.
Yeah.
They're very quick producers as well. You can even get production off of cucumbers. You can do a planting of cucumbers right now and still get cucumbers in the southern half of the state. The northern half of the state, I don't know how to predict when your frost is coming. But as far as cool season crops, it's also the time to think about things that actually do survive the frost. Carrots, radishes, lettuce, spinach, all of those things can be planted now for a beautiful fall harvest when the weather's cool.
And you'll be ready for it, ready for them then for sure. Patty Nagai, our guest today. Patty is a retired UW Extension horticulture educator, and it's great to have her with us for Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest, Patty Nagai, retired UW Extension horticulture educator. Questions for her, give a call at 800-642-1234 or email to ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Dahl in Oshkosh has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, thank you for calling.
Actually, it's Dale.
Oh, but, Dale, sorry.
Yeah, not a problem. Hey, thanks, Larry, for taking the call. And Patty, I've got a question for you in my little patch in my backyard of black raspberries. I've noticed what looks to be like poison hemlock. I've also noticed some of it up by my cabin mm-hmm. in Shawano County. And I'm just wondering, am I barking up the wrong tree, or is this... is this a problem in the area, and how do I eradicate?
Well, I know we have poison hemlock in various parts of the state, but I personally have never encountered it in my area. Have you looked it up on the DNR site?
Well, I've looked online. I've seen several articles from like Ohio and I think out west somewhere.
Uh-huh.
The thing that it piqued my interest right away was the old warning, you know, leaves of three, leave it be. And I noticed this weird kind of arrow, kind of jagged arrowhead shaped leaves clustered in threes, and the real small white umbrella shaped flower. Somewhat reminiscent of Queen Anne's lace, but very, you know, only a few very small little flower head on it.
Okay.
And they're starting to turn to seed, but I've noticed that in my little tiny backyard, I've got probably about 10 or 12 plants that they're growing like crazy, and they do have the characteristic purple splotching on the stems.
Hmm.
Okay. Well, it may very well be that. I mean, we do have it in the state. One of the things you should be aware of is that if you let the seeds mature, you know, you could have tens of thousands of seeds in your yard. So it'll be an ongoing issue. And that probably is what has happened, that at some point one flower head matured, and now you've got the seed in the ground. I'm going to refer you to go to the Wisconsin DNR site and look up poison hemlock.
They have good.
It's really interesting
there.
Because you know there are some similarities between poison hemlock and giant hogweed, but they, you know, when you look at the comparisons, they're of course very different plants, but people do get them confused. Larry was telling me that someone had brought up angelica as well. Angelica is another plant that grows in our native areas and along woodland areas, and it has some similar characteristics. Now, Angelica is not poisonous, but giant hogweed, cow parsnip, and of course poison hemlock are. So it's important to identify exactly which species you're looking at. And the telltale characteristics, as it seems like you know, are the shape of the leaves, the type of leaf, that purple mottling, whether or not there are hairs on the leaves, hairs on the stems, the shape of the flower cluster. With the poison hemlock, sometimes the flowers look more greenish than white, but they will be white eventually. So it's just super important to get a positive identification before you handle it and before you look at methods for eradication. But if it is one of the species that you really don't want in your yard, it's really important to get those flowers off carefully so that they don't set seed and produce even more plants in your yard. But the positive ID is super important. So take close-up pictures of the flower, the leaf, get the height of the plant, the spread. And I would say head over to your extension office and talk to someone there, or do the comparison on the Wisconsin DNR site and make sure that you know what you're dealing with.
Yeah. Good luck, Del. Yeah. Thank you.
Be careful.
Yeah.
Be careful out there.
Steve in Madison, this goes back to watering, wondering, he's got some fruit trees, and wondering if watering away from the plant to encourage root development is also a good idea for fruit trees you were mentioning.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. So there's definitely advantage to watering up close to the plant when it's newly planted. But if you remember a call previously where we had, little seedlings coming up, little shoots, not seedlings, but little shoots coming up 15 feet away from a tree, you have to think about how far out those roots are growing. And that's going to be age dependent. If the tree has only been in the ground for a year or two, the roots are still going to be really close to where you planted it. It's not going to have it expanded very much. But after year two, three, certainly four, five, those roots are going to be really spreading out. So for a lot of trees, we say water at the drip line. Make sure that you're watering all the way out to the drip line. But in actuality, when you're trying to get a tree established, you should go beyond the drip line, because eventually that's where those roots are going to go. And you want to make sure that there's moisture in the soil to support those developing roots and to attract them. You want to encourage them to be as big and long as possible.
Brian in Blue Mounds, we'll go to you now. Hi, Brian.
Yeah, hi, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I got a, I'm not going to say a small fruit orchard, but I've been spraying the fruit trees with neem oil,
mm-hmm.
and that seems to work on the apples and mm-hmm. the peaches and the nectarines, but
right.
I have black leaf spot on my two pear trees,
mm-hmm.
and I was hoping the neem oil would take care of it, and it didn't.
It didn't.
I guess, what's my course of action to try and get, the pears are lost for this year because they're gone, but.
There are some organic options for fungal inhibition on fruit trees. Neem oil actually has some antifungal activities, but it just seems to be inconsistent with how it actually works. And a lot of it has to do with how it's applied, how frequently it's applied, the actual concentration of neem oil. There are a lot of different factors that can affect the activity of an organic spray application like neem oil. So it has antifungal and, of course, anti-insect kind of properties, which makes it a really valuable organic option. But there are other organic options for fungicides as well. They mostly include things like copper and sulfur. So copper is, although considered organic, it is a metal that can accumulate in the soil, and it can accumulate in your apple trees, or your pear trees, it can accumulate in your body. So even though it's organic, I have to give you all those precautions about make sure that you're applying it correctly and safely. And it's too late to apply fungicides this time of year. So it's not an option the damage essentially is already there. The disease is already there. You're not, fungicides work by protecting the healthy growth. And, you know, I know it's still summer, but we're really at the end of leaf production season.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you need to make a plan for next year. So there are some options for applying things like dormant oil to the trunks and branches of the tree once the foliage has dropped. And I would suggest that you look into that as a potential option for control of certain fungal spores and insects as well. And there are some very nice organic oils out there that you can use in that fashion. I'm not sure, but I think that there is a publication on organic fruit production that's available that will give you more detail about the timing of these applications. If not, when you go to purchase the dormant oil, just read the label. You need to read the label anyway because that's the law. But read the label very carefully about the time of application and the method and the temperature restrictions especially. But I believe on the pear publication, I think that there are some organic options listed in that pear publication that's available through UW Extension, which is now UW-Madison Extension, right? UW.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, you can look for Wisconsin Pear Culture, and that publication should pop up.
There you go. Thank you so much. And you mentioned neem oil, and Jill Nadeau was telling me, she was filling in for me last week. Mm-hmm. I was on vacation, and the guest last week advised about, you know, careful about using neem oil or mm-hmm. using it sparingly because it kills everything, including the good insects.
It does. It's an oil, and it doesn't have a... It doesn't know good from bad. So, yes, it is important to use it carefully. And that's true with any pesticide. You know, whether it's organic or natural or synthetic or, you know, whatever, you need to read the label and follow the instructions carefully and only use it when it's really necessary.
Yeah. Let's take another call. You can join in, too, 800-642-1234. Marilyn in Mequon, your turn. Hi, Marilyn.
Oh, hi. How can I remove quack grass that is growing in a perennial bed with several Allium summer beauty plants?
Oh, my gosh. Quack grass. It's awful.
Yeah.
Hard. Yeah, that's a hard
especially
one.
Especially where it is, where you have it.
So there are certainly herbicides that will kill quack grass, but you would have to do very careful application. You could try digging it out, and that's going to be a constant issue.
And you're leaving little pieces in there.
Yeah, because you can't really get it all out. Careful application of an herbicide specifically for quack grass or one of the total vegetation killers will work. But again, very careful application.
Yeah.
Sometimes you can take a shield, create a shield around the plants that you're trying to protect. And even if you're doing a drip or a paint application of an herbicide, it's a good idea to kind of contain your foliage of your desirable plants, in this case, the alliums, just to make sure you don't get an accidental touching of the foliage. Yeah, other than that, it's just, you know, you could try smothering it, but you'd probably have to have 10 inches of mulch to smother quack grass. Yeah.
Yeah. Debbie from Elgin, Illinois emailed. She bought a Harry Lauder's walking stick mm-hmm. this spring at a local nursery, potted it up to enjoy on her deck, and mm-hmm. planning on planting it in the backyard mm-hmm. in September.
Mm-hmm.
Some of the leaves have black spots on mm-hmm. the underside and are curling. Mm-hmm. She's wondering, is that wilt or what is it?
Well, it's some fungal disease, most likely. I don't know if they get any galls. Sometimes things like that are like little insect galls, but without seeing it, I don't know. Harriet Lauder walking stick has all sorts of interesting challenges disease-wise. But I would say if it's just a few leaves, I would not be concerned about it. And if you have a lot of extra time, you could just go pick those leaves off and dispose of them just in case. Because if they're fungal, they're going to be full of spores, which will proliferate. If it's an insect gall, there's a little critter in there.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. It doesn't sound familiar to me. The other thing that you could do is take some nice pictures or bring a sample into your extension office. You could, of course, send a sample into the disease diagnostic clinic. The wonderful thing about Dr. Huddleston is if he sees it and says, hey, that's not a disease, he'll take it over to PJ Leash and for
give
insect
it to him.
ID. So they'll, you know, take a look at it there as well. Fall is a great time to plant it. And like we've been talking throughout the program, just make sure that you don't plant it too deeply, that you water it thoroughly when you plant it, and that you provide a nice, healthy layer of organic mulch to protect that root zone.
Dan in Janesville, what's on your mind?
Hi. So I have some maple trees that were planted on my property, I would say about 20 years ago. And out of an abundance of caution for them splitting, because there's like two main leaders on them,
mm-hmm.
I've pruned them. And taking some of those lower limbs off. I read online that kind of right in the middle of summer is the best time to do sugar maples. Is there something that I can put on those wounds that, you know, just is better for the tree going into its dormant season? And what can I do to eliminate, you know, the splitting? Because I have had one split on my property mm-hmm. already.
Mm-hmm. Are you sure they're sugar maples?
I don't know if they're sugar maples. I think they just might be like a autumn blaze type maple.
Well, autumn blaze is a Freemani. And the reason I'm asking is that it's common for silver maples to have multiple trunks like that eventually split. The other one, of course, is the box elder, which is a soft maple, you know, the Acer Negundo. Yeah, it'll split like that too. But it's more unusual for sugar maple or Freemani maple to have a double trunk like that, to have those narrow crotches where you worry about the tree splitting. It's way more common for a silver maple to do that. So take a good look at your leaf structure and your trunk and the bark and all of that, and see if you can get a more positive ID on the species. Because it's just nice to know what tree you're dealing with. As far as painting the wounds, it is never a good idea to paint wounds, cutting, pruning wounds on anything unless you have had an unexpected injury to something like an
red oak.
Elm or an oak tree, where we worry about disease transmission. And those are the only times that we actually recommend any kind of covering on a pruning or any other kind of wound on a tree. And the reason for that is that the tree is perfectly capable of sealing over that wound by itself. And if you apply anything to it, you're interfering with that process. So it may look hideous and it may weep and ooze and look horrible, like, what have I done? But believe me, the tree is doing what it needs to do in order to seal over that wound. So please, please don't paint your pruning cuts.
Dan, thank you for calling. Rebecca in Sheboygan, it's your turn. Hi, Rebecca.
Yes, hi. Thank you for taking my call. I have a couple of large purple phlox plants, the tall kind that mm-hmm. grow up and flower mm-hmm. in August or mm-hmm. late July.
Sure.
And they have fungus on the bottom of them as soon mm-hmm. as I get flowers. Like mm-hmm. all the leaves start dying and they look terrible. The flowers look great.
Sure.
It doesn't affect the flowers at all.
Nope.
But the leaves look terrible.
Yes.
I don't know what to do about it.
Well, phlox are notorious for getting powdery mildew. And we talked about powdery mildew earlier, and I think it's important to note that powdery mildew is a name we use sort of generically for a very large group of diseases. So the powdery mildew that you get on phlox is not the same one that gets on lilac or hollyhock or veronica or any of the other ones. They're all different species of diseases. But their symptoms are very similar. Their appearance is very similar as far as why they appear. So there are some plants that are just super susceptible to powdery mildew. And phlox is one of those. So if the plants are really close together, if you don't have good air movement, if they're in a partially shady situation, if the humidity's too high, powdery mildew is just one of those opportunistic diseases that's going to come in and do that. That's why you see so many new varieties of garden phlox on the market that say mildew resistant, because it's something that, you know, they've been breeding for years, trying to find a phlox that won't get powdery mildew. But they do get it. And you can try as soon as you see it. You could remove the diseased leaves right away, but eventually you're going to end up with a stalk with no foliage and just a nice little puffy flower head at the top, which is super attractive. So there are some, of course, fungicides that you can use, but just like any of the fungal disease recommendations, those fungicides have to be applied before the foliage is actually infected. So at the very first signs of powdery mildew, and you have to look for it really carefully, you know, you'll see like little white patches on the foliage. That's when you have to start applying the fungicides. And there are some organic options, but you, again, have to be very careful about application and follow all the label instructions. And then there are some synthetic fungicides that are approved for garden use that, you know, fungicides that can even be used on things like tomatoes to stop septoria and early leaf blight. It's just important to follow the label instructions and apply them correctly and at the right time. Once you've reached a stage where the foliage is dropping and everything's brown, it's too late to apply a fungicide, so you just have to put that into your gardening plan for next year. This is where, you know, a garden journal is really helpful because you go, 1st of July, you open your journal and go, well, last 1st of July, my phlox looked great, but by July 14th, they looked really awful. Maybe I should get a fungicide.
There you go, Rebecca. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Stacy in Sun Prairie, do you have a quick question for us?
Hi, Larry. Yes, I have corn that's about 4.5 foot tall, maybe, and there's no ears or anything, but it's already tasseling.
Oh, that's sad.
Yeah.
So how close together did you plant your corn?
They're fairly close together, yeah.
Yeah.
So the interesting thing about corn, and if you plant the seeds too close together and they don't get thinned out, essentially what you're doing is it's just producing foliage, because they won't set the ears. Now, a lot of times with sweet corn, the tassel production is off from the ear production. So it's possible you might see some ears later on, but then you're not going to have any pollen to pollinate them, which is another reason that sometimes people plant two different kinds of corn in order to get good pollination. It's a struggle sometimes. It is.
It's always a challenge, as we were talking about.
Yes, challenges of the garden. I'm with you. I feel for you, and I'm so sorry. But there's always positives, right, Larry? Let's end on a positive note.
The positive note is you'll come back and be with us again.
Absolutely.
Patty DeGuy, our guest today, retired UW Extension horticulture educator. Great to have her with us. Monday, Jennifer Cheverini is back to talk about her new book, and that will look at the Vets Museum of Wisconsin and the role of women in the war. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend, but stay with us. I'm Larry Mueller.